This CLE is based on the New York State appellate decisions released in July 2020 dealing with criminal law issues. The substantive criminal law decisions released in July were summarized, and the summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website. Those summaries have been compiled into the July 2020 criminal law update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for this course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. There's a link to the pamphlet on the podcast page for the July 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE. First case is People versus Romeiser on page 6. The decision is of interest because the appellate court heard considered whether there was legally sufficient evidence in the case, despite the lack of preservation. Unfortunately, the case does not go into the facts, but it's a notable case because the legally insufficient evidence issue usually must be preserved by a motion for a trial order of dismissal. But in this case, the issue was heard in the interest of justice. Fourth Department, reversing defendant's assault convictions and dismissing the indictment, held the evidence of recklessness was legally insufficient. Although the issue was not preserved by the motion for a trial order of dismissal, the appeal was heard in the interest of justice. And again, the facts were not described. The court wrote, defendant failed to preserve that contention for our review because her motion for a trial order of dismissal was not specifically directed at the ground advanced on appeal. We nevertheless exercise our power to review her challenge as a matter of discretion in the interest of justice, and the court cited Criminal Procedure Law 470.15, Subdivision 6A. Next is People v. Minichia. M-I-N-E-C-C-I-A, page 7. It's a case that deals with attorney conflict of interest. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to vacate his conviction after a bench trial should have been granted. The initial prosecutor in defendant's case became the trial judge's law clerk. Defendant was never informed and waived his right to a jury trial. Defendant argued he would not have waived a jury trial had he known the former prosecutor was the trial judge's law clerk. And the court wrote, the evidence at the hearing established that the prosecutor who appeared for over 6 months on the people's behalf during the preliminary proceedings in this case was subsequently appointed to serve as the trial court's confidential law clerk. When the law clerk brought that conflict to the trial court's attention, the trial court appropriately screened the law clerk off from any participation in this case. When defendant sought to waive his right to a jury trial and to be tried by the court alone, however, the trial court, which had recognized the conflict and had already taken steps to mitigate it, failed to inform defendant that its law clerk had previously prosecuted defendant in this case. Moreover, although defense counsel was aware of the law clerk's prior role as prosecutor, it is undisputed that defense counsel failed to inform defendant of that fact. Defense counsel subsequently admitted that had he recalled the fact that the prosecutor had become the trial court's law clerk, he would have advised defendant to retain his right to a jury trial. Additionally, defendant testified at the post-trial hearing that he would not have waived his right to a jury trial had he been aware of the fact that his former prosecutor was now serving as the trial court's law clerk. Contrary to the motion court's determination, defendant's testimony in that regard was not incredible. Indeed, defendant identified rational case-specific reasons why he distrusted the fairness of the law clerk. Next is People v. Jenkins, which is on page 8, another case dealing with the actions of the prosecutor. First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Oing, that's O-I-N-G, affirmed defendant's murder conviction after addressing several unusual issues in depth. First issue, the prosecutor obtained an ex parte order allowing the opening and reading of defendant's non-legal mail to determine whether defendant was threatening an eyewitness. After reading two batches of mail, the prosecutor determined no threats were being made, informed defense counsel of the order, and turned the mail over to defense counsel. The First Department held there were no related grounds for disqualifying the prosecutor or for granting a mistrial. Second issue, when the defendant was on the stand, he denied knowing the knife, which was the murder weapon, could be flipped open with one hand. During her questioning, the prosecutor demonstrated that the knife could be flipped open. The Second Department held the prosecutor as an unsworn witness argument did not warrant a mistrial, in part because of the curative instructions to the jury. Third issue, the knife was brought into the jury room after a request from the jury about which the court and the attorneys were not made aware. The judge and the attorneys had agreed that the jury's examination of the knife would be allowed, and the examination was done according to the agreed procedure. This was not an ORAMA violation because it involved only the examination of a physical object, not an instruction or the substance of any trial evidence. Therefore, a mistrial on this ground was not warranted. Next is People v. Hunt on page 9. It's a constructive possession case involving the strength of DNA evidence. The Fourth Department reversing defendant's possession of a weapon conviction, applying a weight of the evidence analysis, held the defendant's DNA on the weapon in his presence and his presence as a passenger in the car where their weapon was found was not enough. The court wrote, "It's undisputed that the driver owned the vehicle and that the duffel bag belonged to him as well. The people relied on evidence that defendant's DNA profile matched that of the major contributor to DNA found on the handgun and that the driver was excluded as a contributor. Although an inference could be made from that evidence, the defendant had physically possessed the gun at some point in time. That evidence alone does not establish that defendant actually possessed the handgun on the date and at the time alleged in the indictment. Defendant was not the owner or operator of the vehicle, nor did the duffel bag in the locked trunk belong to him, and there was no evidence that defendant possessed or had access to the keys for the vehicle or that he had any access to or control over the trunk and the duffel bag. Contrary to the people's contention, defendant's statement to the police did not constitute an admission that he possessed the handgun or that he knew about its presence in the duffel bag, and in any event, mere knowledge of the presence of the handgun would not establish constructive possession." Next is Matter of Stoughton on page 10 or 9 and 10. It's a habeas corpus petition and it involves the prison's attempts at controlling the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. First Department held the petitions for writs of habeas corpus brought by inmates at Rikers Island arguing the risk of contracting COVID-19 at the jail required release were properly denied. State and federal constitutional arguments were raised. The analysis came down to weighing the danger to the inmates against the danger to the public entailed by release. The court wrote, "Far from acting recklessly, respondents, that's the city and the state, have demonstrated great care to ensure the safety of everyone who enters the facility. By any objective measure, they have been anything but indifferent to the risk that COVID-19 poses to the jail population. That the state has agreed to release a significant number of detainees to help control the spread of the virus actually demonstrates that it has given a great deal of consideration to who should and who should not be released, and its decision not to release petitioners based on their criminal history backgrounds is thus persuasive. Coupled with what the state and city have done to protect detainees discussed above, we conclude that weighing the interests falls in the respondent's favor." So again, the habeas corpus petitions seeking relief because of the pandemic were denied in that case. Next is People v. Campbell on pages 10 and 11. It deals with the adequacy of expert opinion about the nature of a controlled substance. The Second Department reversing defendant's conviction on two drug possession counts, held that people did not provide a proper foundation for the testimony of two experts who tested the substances alleged to contain cocaine. The court wrote, "The opinion testimony by these experts was inadmissible because the people failed to lay a foundation for the competence of the testimony. An expert who tests a substance for the presence of cocaine may not rely solely upon a test involving a comparison of the substance at issue to a known standard when the accuracy of the known standard is not established. Here the evidence adduced at trial reflected that Lynn and Lopez each tested the purity of a sample of the substance recovered from the defendant by using a test which relied upon a comparison to a known standard. The people failed to introduce any direct evidence as to the accuracy of the standard used for comparison. Supreme Court should not have permitted their testimony, and a new trial is required on the counts charging criminal possession of a controlled substance in the fifth degree." Next is Property Clerk, New York City Police Department. It's on page 12, and it deals with whether the forfeiture of defendant's car was constitutional. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether forfeiture of defendant's vehicle would impose an excessive hardship and would constitute a constitutionally impermissible excessive fine. Defendant pled guilty to possession of a weapon which was found in the vehicle. The court wrote, "Defendant, acting pro se, submitted an affidavit and supporting evidence in support of his argument that forfeiture of the vehicle, which he needed for getting to work with his tools and picking up his children from school, would impose an excessive and tremendous hardship on him and his family, particularly given that this is his sole criminal offense and in light of other mitigating facts. This evidence is sufficient to raise an issue of fact as to whether, under all the factual circumstances, civil forfeiture of the vehicle would be grossly disproportionate to the offense and therefore a constitutionally impermissible excessive fine." Next is People v. Reed on pages 13 and 14. It addresses whether the evidence before the grand jury was legally sufficient. The Third Department, reversing County Court, held on the People's Appeal, the evidence presented to the grand jury was legally sufficient to support the charged crimes, aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle. One issue was whether the ID defendant showed to the officer at the traffic stop was sufficient to connect the defendant to the Department of Motor Vehicles abstract. The court wrote, "In view of defendant's admission to the police officer during the stop that he did not have a driver's license, as well as the information in the certified abstract from the Department of Motor Vehicles, the evidence was legally sufficient to support the charges in the indictment. Furthermore, by producing the identification card to the police officer, defendant adopted the information therein, including his date of birth. Accordingly, contrary to defendant's assertion, there was admissible evidence connecting defendant to the abstract. Because the record discloses that the evidence before the grand jury was legally sufficient to support the charged crimes, the indictment must be reinstated." Next is People v. Hernandez on pages 14 and 15. It deals with the adequacy of a plea colloquy. The Fourth Department vacated defendant's plea to burglary because the colloquy negated an essential element of the offense. The court noted that this type of error does not require preservation for appeal. The intent to commit burglary includes the intent to commit a crime in the premises other than trespass. The court wrote, "Defendant negated the intent to commit a crime therein element of burglary," that's Penal Law Section 140.25, "because his factual recitation contradicted any allegation that he intended to commit a crime in the apartment other than his trespass. Criminal trespass in the second degree cannot itself be used as the sole predicate crime in the intent to commit a crime therein element of burglary. The court thus had a duty to conduct an inquiry to ensure that defendant understood the nature of the crime. Instead, the court stated, "I just want to make sure that you still accept the plea deal because you have an absolute right to go to trial. I think you understand that your defense of you going to the bathroom may be difficult to sell to a jury. Because that minimal inquiry by the court did not clarify the nature of the crime in order to ensure that the plea was intelligently entered, the court erred in accepting the guilty plea. Next is People versus Patillo or Patillo on page 15, another guilty plea case. Second Department vacating defendant's guilty plea to murder, in a full opinion by Justice Manzanate Daniels, determined defendant's intellectual disability required a more probing colloquy to ensure defendant understood the ramifications of the plea and the waiver of appeal. The court wrote, "The records indicated that with an IQ of only 56, defendant had extremely low general cognitive ability with overall thinking and reasoning abilities in the bottom 0.2%. Those records further indicated that defendant's verbal comprehension, perceptual reasoning, working memory, and processing speed were extremely low in the bottom 0.2 to 2%. The Criminal Procedure Law Section 390 report ordered by the trial court in aid of sentencing confirmed the doubts regarding defendant's mental capacity and ability to understand or participate in the proceedings. Next is People v. Snow on page 16. It deals with the admissibility of hearsay when the hearsay goes to a core issue in the case. The Fourth Department reversing defendant's robbery conviction and ordering a new trial on that count, held the defendant should have been allowed to present a witness to demonstrate the note he presented to the bank employee did not threaten the use of force, which is an element of the robbery charge. The Fourth Department noted that secondary evidence, hearsay testimony, and extrinsic documentary evidence, the note, which is prohibited for collateral issues, may be admissible when the evidence is relevant to a core issue. The court wrote, "Where the truth of the matter asserted in the proffered inconsistent statement is relevant to a core factual issue of a case, its relevancy is not restricted to the issue of credibility, and its probative value is not dependent on the inconsistent statement. Under such circumstances, the right to present a defense may encompass the right to place before the trier of fact secondary forms of evidence such as hearsay. Inasmuch as the content of the note was relevant to whether defendant, either explicitly or implicitly, threatened the use of force, we conclude that the proposed testimony pertained to a non-collateral issue and that the court should have allowed the proposed witness to testify." Next is People v. Carmona on page 17. It's an identification case. Second Department affirmed defendant's conviction over a substantive dissent. Arguing against a Wade hearing addressing the suggestiveness of the complainant's identification of the defendant from single photograph displays, the prosecutor told the judge the complainant and the defendant knew each other and the identification procedures were merely confirmatory. Defendant denied knowing the complainant and requested a Rodriguez hearing. The judge denied the request based on the people's assertion the identification procedures were confirmatory. The denial of the Rodriguez hearing was deemed to be error, but the majority concluded the hearing was not necessary because the trial testimony demonstrated the complainant knew the defendant. The dissent argued the Court of Appeals, in the Rodriguez case, required resolution of the identification issue before the trial. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court erred in relying on the people's mere assurances of familiarity in denying the defendant's pretrial request for a Rodriguez hearing. Nevertheless, a hearing with regard to the single photograph identifications made by the complainant soon after the shooting was ultimately unnecessary inasmuch as the complainant's trial testimony demonstrated that he was sufficiently familiar with the defendant whom he knew and who he referred to by his street name." Next is People v. Quiros on page 18. Deals with the sufficiency of an indictment that was duplicitous. The Fourth Department held the prosecutor had remedied the duplicity in the indictment by providing information in a supplemental bill of particulars and a trial indictment after the motion to dismiss for duplicity was made, information corroborated by detailed trial evidence. The court wrote, Because defendant was convicted only of those counts of rape in the first degree where pretrial notice of specific instances was given and where those specific instances were proved at trial, we conclude the dismissal of those counts as duplicitous was not required. Next is People v. Taylor. On pages 20 and 21, it's a juror's challenge case, a Batson challenge case. Second Department, over an extensive two-justice dissent, held defendant's Batson challenges were properly handled by the court and properly denied. The defense challenged the exclusion of several African-American potential jurors. With respect to one of the potential jurors, Pustum, the prosecutor answered the challenge by simply saying Pustum was not African-American. Although all three stages of a Batson challenge were addressed with respect to the other challenged jurors, nothing further was argued with respect to Pustum. The dissent argued the required three-step process was not followed, with Pustum requiring reversal and a new trial. The court wrote, "The defendant made no argument of any kind as to juror Pustum during step three. Accordingly, she has failed to preserve the specific argument which she raises for the first time on appeal, which is based in part, at least, on facts that are outside the record, to wit, that Pustum's Trinidadian heritage qualifies as African American. Indeed, any appellate consideration of this new argument would require this court to assume facts not within the record, and more importantly, ignore the fact that defense counsel did not dispute or challenge the people's contention that Pustum was not African American." Next is People v. Cobb. On pages 21, another juror challenge case, Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, held that defendant's for-cause challenge to a juror should have been granted. The juror and a prosecution witness were friends. The court wrote, "The prospective juror gave some indication of bias by stating that her friendship with a prosecution witness might affect her ability to be fair and impartial in this case, and that serving as a juror might be awkward in light of that friendship." Next is People v. Savillo on page 22. It addresses the inadequacy of the justification defense jury instructions and also the excessive involvement in the trial by the judge. The Second Department, reversing defendant's convictions for assault second and criminal possession of a weapon fourth, held, "The jury charge did not adequately convey that if the jury acquitted on the top count, which was assault first, based upon the justification defense, it must not consider the lesser counts, and the new trial must be before a different judge because of the judge's excessive involvement. The jury acquitted defendant of assault first." The court wrote, "The court's instructions may have led the jurors to conclude that deliberation on each of the two counts required reconsideration of the justification defense, even if they had already acquitted the defendant of assault in the first degree based on justification. The new trial must be before a different justice. At trial, the Supreme Court engaged in extensive questioning of witnesses, usurped the roles of the attorneys, elicited and assisted in developing facts damaging to the defense on direct examination of the people's witnesses, bolstered the witnesses' credibility, and generally created the impression that it was an advocate for the people." Next is People v. Jones on page 24, deals with an inventory search of a vehicle. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held the firearm seized from defendant's car before the car was towed from a crash scene was not found in a valid inventory search. No written inventory was created. The Third Department held that under the Albany Police inventory search policy, which the court found reasonable, all items in the vehicle should be listed in a written inventory. The dissent argued the policy only required valuable property to be listed. The court wrote, "Despite the reasonableness of the policy, Officer Elliott's testimony reveals that he did not comply with it, and therefore Supreme Court erred in denying defendant's suppression motion. Elliott testified that because nothing of value was found in the car, nothing was seized, and an inventory list was not created relative to the contents of the vehicle. This testimony conflates the requirement that a written inventory always be created with the discretion given to police officers to determine which property is valuable and, as such, must be taken into custody for safekeeping. From his testimony, it's apparent that Elliot did not comply with the policy regarding inventory searches, as it clearly mandates that an inventory search always be completed and the vehicle be completely inventoried, not allowing for discretion of the individual officers. Next is People v. Shehi or Shehi or Shehi, S-H-E-H-I, page 25. It's a sentencing case involving youthful offender status. Although the defendant had already completed his sentences, the Second Department held he was entitled to a determination whether he should be adjudicated a youthful offender, even if that relief was not requested. In addition, the Second Department noted the order of protection exceeded the maximum time allowed in the criminal procedure law and did not take into account defendant's jail time. The court wrote, "Generally, under such circumstances, the sentence is vacated and the matter remitted to the sentencing court for resentencing after determining whether the defendant should be treated as a youthful offender. However, in this case, the defendant has served his sentences. Under these circumstances, we remit the matter to the Supreme Court to determine whether the defendant should be afforded youthful offender treatment and thereafter submit a report to this court advising of its determination. We hold the appeals in abeyance in the interim." Next is People v. Bolt, B-O-L-D-T, pages 26 and 27. It's another sentencing case. Fourth Department held defendant was properly sentenced to imprisonment after a violation of probation in this felony DWI case, despite his completion of the original six-month sentence. Court wrote, "Defendant was not sentenced to a period of imprisonment pursuant to Penal Law Article 70. Rather, he was sentenced on each count to a traditional split sentence pursuant to Penal Law Section 60.01, Subdivision D2, with the period of probation running concurrently with the period of imprisonment. Thus, Penal Law Section 60.21 is inapplicable to this case and does not preclude the imposition of a sentence of imprisonment upon the revocation of probation." So in this case, the initial sentence was a split sentence. The defendant did 6 months of incarceration and then violated probation, and the court said it was permissible to sentence him to additional incarceration. Next is People v. Gravel or Gravel, G-R-A-V-E-L-L, page 30, another sentencing case, this time involving restitution and a plea agreement. The Third Department, vacating the restitution award in the interest of justice, held the restitution ordered was not that agreed to in the plea agreement. The court wrote, "Although defendant failed to preserve his claim by requesting a hearing or objecting to the amount of restitution at sentencing, we deem it appropriate to take corrective action in the interest of justice. As defendant was not sentenced in accordance with the plea agreement, the matter must be remitted to Supreme Court to provide defendant with the opportunity to either accept the sentence with the enhanced restitution award or withdraw his guilty plea. In addition, as Supreme Court failed to set forth the time and manner of payment of the amount of restitution in the restitution order, this omission must be addressed upon remittal." At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this July 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE course. The verification code is put on the attorney affirmation. The code is contraband. Again, the verification code for this July 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE to be placed on your attorney affirmation is contraband. Next is People v. Colon, C-O-L-O-N, pages 32 and 33. It deals with the admissibility of a statement and the appropriateness of sentencing. The Fourth Department held defendant's statement should have been suppressed, but found the error harmless. The Fourth Department also held the defendant was properly sentenced to consecutive sentences for possession of the knife and for murder by stabbing. The court wrote, defendant unequivocally informed the police immediately after being advised of his Miranda rights that he didn't want to talk. No reasonable police officer could have interpreted that statement as anything other than a desire not to talk to the police. Regardless, the police continued the interrogation, thereby failing to scrupulously honor defendant's right to remain silent. With respect to sentencing, the court wrote, consecutive sentencing is permissible here because defendant's act of possessing the knife was accomplished before he used it to kill the victim, and defendant's possession was marked by an unlawful intent separate and distinct from his intent with respect to the homicide. Indeed, the mental state associated with the criminal possession of a weapon count, i.e., the intent to use the knife unlawfully, is discrete from the mental state associated with the homicide count, i.e., negligence. Next is People v. Collins on page 33. It's a street stop case. The First Department reversing Supreme Court and dismissing the indictment held the police who stopped and pursued the defendant did not have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity at the outset, so the weapon discarded by the defendant should have been suppressed. The court wrote, although the police actions began as permissible observation while following defendants slowly in their car without turning their lights on, or lights or sirens on, observation gave way to pursuit when the officers turned on their lights and sirens to cross the street against traffic and pull up ahead of the defendant. Even crediting one of the officers' testimony that his intent was to get a better view and alert oncoming traffic, not to cut off, block, or alarm defendant, the objective impact of this maneuver was intimidating and communicated an attempt to capture or intrude upon defendant's freedom of movement. Because it is undisputed that the circumstances before this police activity were not sufficient to create reasonable suspicion, it was unlawful and could not be validated by any subsequently acquired suspicion. When defendant discarded a handgun during the course of the illegal pursuit, he did not voluntarily abandon it, and it should have been suppressed. And the final case, People v. Perez on page 35. So a motion to vacate the judgment of conviction. The Third Department, reversing county court, held defendant was entitled to a hearing on his motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds. The fact that defendant had made a similar motion, which was denied, did not preclude the instant motion, which, unlike the prior motion, was supported by an affidavit from the attorney who handled defendant's guilty plea. Defendant argued he would not have pled guilty had he been aware of the deportation consequences. The court wrote, the attorney candidly concedes that despite being aware of the fact that defendant was only a lawful permanent resident and not a citizen of the United States at the time that defendant entered his guilty plea, he specifically advised defendant that his guilty plea would have no effect on his lawful permanent resident status and that he would not be deported from the country. So that concludes this July 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE.